It's Monday, March 29th. Justice is blind, but it can also be live-streamed. We start here. Minneapolis, along with the rest of the country, braces itself for the trial of Officer Derek Chauvin.
That's what makes this one different from the rest. We saw exactly what happened with our eyes.
Many Americans already made up their mind, but lawyers only care about 12 people in a box. We'll walk you through how this is about to go down. We haven't felt this optimistic since the pandemic began, and yet more people are getting COVID.
The people that are generating the transmission in the population are still the ones that are undervaccinated.
Now, former Trump officials say we messed up last year, so what are we messing up now? And the coup was more than a month ago, but the real bloodshed just started.
Many of the people who were killed were children and teenagers.
Why the military has begun opening fire on civilians in Myanmar. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. No one trial is ever going to encapsulate everything about race and policing in America, but some cases feel a lot bigger than one victim or one police department.
People were appalled at the jury verdict, asking how could they be not guilty? We saw the crime being committed.
I just want to say, you know, can we all get along?
Rodney King, the man the police beat, appeals for the violence to end.
Well, in perhaps the most anticipated police brutality trial since Rodney King in Los Angeles, with perhaps even more international attention than Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
Michael Brown's family says their son is crying back from the grave, and they would like to know just how much evidence does it take to indict a white police officer for killing a young black man in this country.
And in the aftermath of a death that has already sparked protests and riots. Today, a Minneapolis police officer will be tried for the murder of George Floyd. And while it is just one trial, it's one specific case, what happens next will undoubtedly be seen as a snapshot of how America has evolved in recent years, or whether anything's really changed at all. So let's go straight to Minneapolis, where we find ABC's Alex Perez this morning. Alex, what are we going to see today?
Yeah, Brad, I just want to say you're absolutely right in that this case represents so much more than what's happening inside the courtroom. Some see it as a referendum on America.
I hope that people find it in their heart to see George Floyd's life as valuable. Do they value African-American man's life?
A referendum on sort of the racial problems that this country has faced for decades now.
We can't act like this is George Floyd is an isolated issue, because it's not. It's too many bodies before George Floyd that led up to George Floyd.
Now, in the courtroom, what we're going to see here, a lengthy trial. It's going to run about a month. And in the opening statements, which are sometimes called opening arguments in other states, we expect that the prosecutor is going to make the case that Derek Chauvin used unreasonable force when he restrained George Floyd, and that use of unreasonable force is what led to George Floyd's death.
Let him breathe, least man.
Let him breathe.
Now, unlike other cases, in this case, we have that video that has been seen around the world, and that video is going to play a key role in this case.
As you're viewing the car from the front end there, and George Floyd is on the ground on the other side of the car.
You know, the prosecutor and the defense during jury selection asked those potential jurors, had they seen the video and what they thought of it?
I've saw it. I don't need to see it multiple times. I mean,
that's what makes this one different from the rest. We saw exactly what happened with our eyes.
Well, and that's what I'm wondering. Like, I guess I would expect that to be the case from the prosecution, right? Like, they'll say, hey, you saw it yourself. This guy put his knee on George Floyd's neck. George Floyd died minutes later. This officer killed George Floyd. What is the defense going to say back to that?
Well, the defense is taking a nuanced approach here. And yes, they say that video exists, but they want to dissect the video.
The thing that gives Derek Chauvin a chance here is that he has good lawyers, and they're focusing on an element they believe is weak. The causation.
What they're going to do is go frame by frame. And something Eric Nelson will do is point out those frames in the video where Derek Chauvin's knee is not right exactly on George Floyd's neck. Those moments where it seems to be positioned closer to his shoulder, right, than instead of right on his neck.
One of the things they have to make very sure of, and this is especially true for the government, is that what they say in their opening statement, they can back up with evidence.
And on top of that, the big focus for the defense is going to be what exactly led to George Floyd's death. And their argument is that George Floyd had untreated medical conditions, included an untreated heart condition.
You can assume that they're going to call some of the doctors that they listed on their witness list, and they're going to use those doctors to show there was a possible other cause of death, probably drugs.
They also argue that he abused drugs, and they say that those factors combined are what led to his death.
What's the atmosphere going to be like in the courtroom, Alex? Because this is a different trial. One, it's live streamed, which we don't usually get the benefit of. But on the other hand, there's barely going to be anyone in there.
Yeah, unlike any other trial we've seen before, you're used to seeing the attorney's desks sort of filled with people and a full galley. We're not going to have that in this courtroom because of the pandemic. So the number of people inside the courtroom, extremely limited. You have the prosecutor, the defense team, the judge, the jury, and then two members of the media, pool reporters who are sort of disseminating information for the rest of the media in there. And then just one seat reserved for a Floyd family member and one seat reserved for a supporter of Derek Chauvin, whoever he chooses to have there. But that's it. That's not a lot of people.
Our residents' businesses will visually see more of our citizen soldiers, our guard out there. As well as more of the law enforcement presence.
The courthouse where this is going to happen pretty much looks like a fortress guarded by National Guard troops. Nothing else is happening in this building. The courtroom's on the 18th floor, so the rest of the building going unused right now until this all wraps up.
It's a thin line between hope and hopelessness. It truly is. Especially when you have trust issues, right? We don't trust this system. I know I don't trust this system.
But because of the pandemic, because the limits on people in there, the judge has agreed to allow this to be broadcast, which is, you know, a first for the state of Minnesota. They don't typically broadcast criminal trials here. This one will be broadcast. And given the worldwide interest in this, I'm sure many people are going to be watching.
Yeah, you can only imagine how intimate and charged that room is going to be over the next, like you said, several weeks. In the meantime, authorities are going to be racing to react to whatever is said inside there because everyone outside, activists, protesters, everyone is going to have access to this testimony in real time. All right, we'll see what happens in these opening statements today. Alex Perez in Minneapolis. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Over the weekend, not only did the number of fully vaccinated people in this country tick up towards 16%, but the rate of vaccinations per day continues to accelerate. In fact, on Saturday alone, more than 3.5 million Americans got a shot. However,
it literally makes my brain explode a bit because
you might remember I was talking last week with Diana Barrett, a COVID long hauler. And after we wrapped up our interview, we started talking about how if someone contracts COVID now, tons of Americans can actually now get the same potentially life-saving treatment that President Trump got when he contracted COVID.
It is the most important public health message right now. Everybody's saying vaccine. Remind people that when they get a diagnosis, you only have 3 or 4 days to get this stuff.
And when it comes to that specific treatment, the monoclonal antibody treatments, it's generally recommended for people 65 and older or people at high risk that have certain medical conditions and then they get COVID. And one of those treatments has actually been paused because it's not clear how it handles variants. But this whole idea of people with COVID now got us thinking, if 16% of Americans are vaccinated, that means the vast majority of Americans are still susceptible in many ways. And this weekend, President Trump's former coronavirus response coordinator, Dr. Deborah Birx, said on CNN that thousands of people have already died that shouldn't have. So could more still be on the way? We brought in Dr. John Brownstein from Harvard Medical School. He's also the chief innovation officer at Boston Children's Hospital. And Dr. Brownstein, we've seen COVID cases drop significantly, right, as vaccinations have ramped up. But in several states, we're seeing a plateau or even a rise in some states. Why is that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're not necessarily seeing that steep decline that we once did. We're seeing about 55 to 60,000 new cases every day in the U.S. And there's a number of factors that are driving this: increased mobility, reopenings. But you also have to remember the people that are generating the transmission in the population are still the ones that are under-vaccinated, the younger populations that have yet to be eligible for the vaccines. And they're the ones that are really doing all the transmitting. And so you have that, plus, of course, the presence of variants in the population that are likely more transmissible. That's creating a recipe for, you know, potentially another surge. Now, maybe not as bad as we've seen in the past, but one could say that, you know, every hospitalization and death at this point is truly preventable.
Oh, but so that's like the person who was always going to give you COVID was probably like a young, healthy-ish person. And what do you know? The young, healthy-ish person's like, they're not vaccinated yet.
We've known this from the summer. The surges that we've seen since, you know, the beginning, you know, ultimately have been driven by the people that are doing all the mixing and have all the contacts and are really out there, you know, spreading the virus. It's the problem is that those people then come home and they bring that virus to their vulnerable contacts.
Hey, Glenda, it's not just hospitalizations and cases that are on the rise. It's also the number of variants as the state continues to push out more vaccines to keep up.
And we know that there's still not full coverage of this vaccine, and that's evidenced by the surge in hospitalizations that we're seeing in Michigan.
Our assumption is that many, if not most of these, are the variant, which we know is significantly more transmissible.
What's even more worrying is that, you know, the hospitalizations that we're seeing are in that 30 to 49 age group. So we still have vulnerable parts of the population across every age segment.
Well, I look at it this way. The first time we have an excuse. There were about 100,000 deaths that came from that original surge. All of the rest of them, in my mind, could have been mitigated or decreased substantially.
What was your reaction then to, like, Dr. Deborah Birx this weekend? She said basically, not only is every death going forward preventable, but every death after that 100,000 mark, that initial surge, could have been prevented or at least greatly mitigated.
We've had the tools as far as public health. We've known the ways in which we can prevent transmission. The key was, you know, crystal clear communication and a willingness on the part of the population.
It is extraordinarily widespread. The CNN report in August that got horrible pushback.
To everybody who lives in a rural area, you are not immune or protected from this virus.
That was a very difficult time because everybody in the White House was upset with that interview and the clarity that I brought about the epidemic.
Now, I think the challenge that we had as part of the federal government response is that it wasn't driven by science, it wasn't driven by data, and it was not sort of creating a decisive plan to get this virus under control. And so, yes, I think that if we had been much more proactive, and we've seen other countries that took a much more strong approach to public health control, they were able to come out on top. And so, yes, many deaths.
Is that on people like Dr. Birx then? Like people who were science-driven but part of the administration?
What happened?
Well, I got called by the president.
Well, listen, I think Dr. Birx had a very tough job, of course.
Were you threatened?
I would say it was a very uncomfortable conversation.
But in some ways, she was complicit in sort of the effort of part of the federal government to not truly get this virus under control. And so I think, you know, while, you know, she doesn't deserve all the blame, I think she should take a little bit of responsibility for how bad the response was.
That makes me wonder. So that was then. She's not in control. President Trump's not in charge. She's not in charge. Like, what are the decisions being made right now that a year from now we're going to be saying, oh, wow, like that had really big ramifications. People died or didn't die because of that. Is it vaccine eligibility? Is it treating people who are getting COVID at this moment? Is it variants? Like, what is it?
You know, I think it's hard to know exactly what we'll look back on. But of course, I think the variants play a role.
A new day on South Beach brings a brand new batch of visitors.
We have a group of 12 people. So
I think the rapid reopening that we've seen in many states, I mean, if you look at, you know, spring break and various travel.
The number of flyers is now approaching pre-pandemic numbers.
From Texas to Florida and Georgia. Large groups, little social distancing, few masks in sight.
That was probably allowed too quickly. There was no reason to go, you know, full reopen. And so I think we'll look back and say, why did we move too quickly in the home stretch.
This comes as vaccine distribution ramps up across the country. Johnson & Johnson on track to deliver 20 million doses by the end of March, 11 million set to go out next week, and demand only soaring.
If you look at, you know, daily average of 2.5 million or more vaccines a day, that's pretty amazing. And, you know, we are covering a large portion of the vulnerable population, the elderly population. So I think we should feel very good about that.
But if people just put aside all public health measures, namely put the masks aside, go to bars, go to restaurants, you're going to see a surge.
But it's, you know, really these final moments where, you know, there's no reason to get tripped up, right, as you're clearing third base.
All right, Dr. John Brownstein there in Massachusetts. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, you'd call the government for help, except it's the government shooting at you. The day Myanmar truly got ugly after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the things about a military coup is how sudden it can be. And because of the swiftness, some coups are actually rather bloodless. And when the military showed up at the capital of Myanmar in early February, there was really no shootout, no war in the streets. Lawmakers were arrested by the military and taken away. But just because a coup is bloodless does not mean that there is not violence lurking. In fact, the threat of violence is the reason it often works in the first place. And this weekend, we've seen just how bloody the military in Myanmar is willing to get. Let's go to ABC's Julia McFarlane from our foreign desk. Julia, this all seemed to really reach its peak this weekend. What happened?
Right, so Saturday was the bloodiest day since the Myanmar military overthrew the democratically elected government last month. The United Nations estimates that more than 100 people were killed. And what was so brutal about this weekend's events is many of the people who were killed were children and teenagers. Yesterday, you had funerals all across the country because the violence happened in more than 40 towns. You just see endless images of these parents mourning and burying their children.
And why is it the young people that are dying? And in what way are they dying? Is this confrontations with the military? Is this random shooting into crowds? What are we talking about?
This movement is really being driven by the youth of Myanmar.
Don't be on my shoulder! Don't be on my shoulder!
And yet, judging from the footage that is coming out of Myanmar, it certainly looks as though the military have, at times, attacked protesters and civilians at random. We've seen footage of security forces brutally kicking and beating unarmed protesters with nothing in their hands. We've seen troops on an SUV stop in the middle of the road to start firing on three guys on a motorcycle, wounding one as he falls to the floor, two others fleeing. They reportedly managed to keep their lives. Many others didn't. Initially, when these protests first started happening, it was water cannon, it was tear gas. It then became stun grenades, rubber bullets.
On Friday, state media had warned that protesters risked being shot to the head and back.
And now the soldiers are increasingly using live ammunition into these heavily packed, very dense crowds of protesters who are demanding that the military step down and restore the democratically elected government.
Well, and so, Julia, it sounds like what you're describing is, since February 1st, there's this pattern that's emerged where crowds hold protests, they confront the military or police, the guys with guns refuse to back down because they're like, well, we can't give up power here, so they fire back. The protesters now get even angrier because their friends have been killed, and the next day everyone just does the same thing, just with heightened violence. How long can that pattern continue?
Right. It certainly appears to be a crescendo. And the other thing you need to understand is, while we're looking at all of these really incredibly dramatic pictures of protests and clashes and violence, another thing that's going on is widespread strikes across the country.
I am not going out anywhere or participating in any ways that would disturb the silent strike.
Thousands of civil servants are just refusing to go to work. You have shops refusing to sell to policemen, to the military.
At least nine unions covering sectors including construction, agriculture and manufacturing have called on all Myanmar people to stop work.
So you have a lot of the machinery of state is grinding to a halt.
Any reaction to what happened in Myanmar?
It's terrible. It's absolutely outrageous. And based on the reporting I've gotten, an awful lot of people have been killed totally unnecessarily.
Now, what is really important for the international community to understand is that the military is not just the country's armed forces. The Myanmar military, they have steep ties to business. They control a lot of big companies. And last week, the US and the UK, they stepped up their sanctions. Previously, they have imposed sanctions on members of the military and their families and singling out individuals tied to the regime. Last week, they imposed asset freezes and travel bans on two big conglomerates, which have steep ties to the military, because the diplomatic community, as the UN Special Rapporteur for Myanmar's human rights, said that sanctions have to be stepped up. You can't just have harsh words against the military. Something has to be done to bring them to heel.
Yeah, any thought that the military would sort of step in and say, hey, we run things for 1 year, the crowd in Myanmar is certainly not buying that. And any idea that this would all just be nonviolent, we just wait for a year, that's clearly out the window now. Julie McFarlane, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
And one last thing, it's the song of the summer.
What does it sound like?
Sort of sounds like a cat purring.
If you don't know what that sound is, it's because you might be too young to remember the last time America's biggest batch of cicadas took over the skies.
We saw one and we thought, oh, we're having a good time now. And then the sidewalk started moving.
These are insects, way bigger than flies, but not quite locusts, who actually live underground for most of their lives. They're tunneling around, feeding on tree nutrients for up to 17 years. Well, when the weather warms up, they crawl above ground and start making that famous clicking sound, which can get as loud as a big lawnmower. In fact, 17 years ago, there are news stories about cicadas being so loud outside Baltimore, they were technically breaking local noise ordinances. Now, there are other cicadas, you might have heard them, but this is Brood 10, the biggest and most concentrated in the country. So this summer, you'll see billions of Brood 10ers taking over trees and neighborhoods from Georgia to New York to Michigan.
So some will come out a little bit early, some will come out a little bit later, but you can kind of predict that May is going to be a loud month. for sure, for cicadas.
And because of their lifespan, the world they climb into every 17 years is way different from the one before. Things change quick. Take insects. At this point, because of climate change and property development, the U.S. is losing 9% of its land insects every decade. That means every time a cicada wakes up, the number of six-legged neighbors has been cut by 15%. In fact, ABC's chief meteorologist Ginger Zee says when cicadas are sticking to their really loud script, that's a good sign.
This is good news because it actually means that our ecosystem's doing well.
We've seen declines in pollinators, spiders, and other bugs for years now, which has had huge reverberating effects up the food chain. Remember, even for humans, one-third of our food relies at some level on insects.
The cicada's been around for millions of years, and they've adapted to all different types of changes in the climate. However, they have never seen the rapidity of change that we have happening right now because of us. So they really don't know how the cicada is going to react.
In fact, warmer climates mean you could see cicadas more often. Warmer air means longer growing seasons. That's good news for some farmers. It's great for cicadas who get so buff off of one summer, they're ready to make their debut several years early. But those temperatures also mean weather catastrophes. They mean droughts in places like Central America. That's right, our border policies are not the only things causing mass migration. And these temperatures can cause the deaths of millions of less annoying insects. So scientists say, even if you feel trapped inside of a jet engine this summer, just be thankful that the cicada is making an appearance at all, and hopefully that they'll be back 17 years from now. I'm telling you, the birds in my neighborhood, they can already tell something's up. Like, they just look hungry. Hey, big news in the Start Here world, we just turned 3 years old, you guys. Yesterday was technically the show's birthday, so a huge thank you to those who have been listening to us, whether it's 3 years or 1 year or you just found out about us. Remember, the best birthday gift you can give us is a rating and review telling your friends about us, but we are just so happy to have this community of listeners with us. And since we're 3 years old, apparently this means we have some fine motor skills that we can ride a tricycle now. So I've got some celebrating to do. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.